Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Melissa Amarello. After more than a decade working on the conservation of reptiles in the American Southwest, Melissa co-founded Advocates for Snake Preservation in 2014 to change how people view and treat snakes. She holds a master's in biology for her studies of rattlesnake social behavior. So first, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks for having me again. It's so nice to talk to you.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you too. So how if we just start with an introduction to snakes themselves, like an evolutionary and ecological introduction, and then after that, an introduction to human relations with snakes?
Sounds great. So I'll give sort of I want to talk a little bit about what makes snakes unique. And so that'll be a little bit about how they're different from us. But I also, in our work, we found it, you know, really helpful in getting people to connect with snakes. And so sort of getting towards the human-snake relationship to talk about things that we have in common with snakes that they don't get as much attention, those issues. So snakes are reptiles, and reptiles are sometimes called cold-blooded. The technical term is ectothermic, and it just means that they depend on their environment and their behavior in their environment for their body temperature. So they don't have to use calories to keep themselves warm like mammals do, and also birds. And scientists think that dinosaurs were also warm-blooded, not cold-blooded as well. And other reptiles include crocodilians, so alligators and crocodiles, tuataras, which look like lizards, but are different enough to be their own special group of just a couple species that live in New Zealand, turtles and tortoises, and lizards and snakes. And snakes are actually sort of nested within lizards. They're a specialized group of lizards. And I think a lot of people assume that, oh, they're the legless ones. They're lizards without legs. And it is true that snakes don't have legs, but there's actually a few species of lizards that don't have legs either, and not necessarily the lizards that are most closely related to snakes. It's just a trait, the loss of legs, that has evolved multiple times, because when you're spending a lot of time underground, or even think about moving along a forest floor with like some really thick leaf litter, so you're not really underground, but you're sort of swimming in the leaves, it's a lot easier and faster to do that without legs. And so where I live in Southwest New Mexico, we have lizards called alligator lizards. And they do have legs, but they're these really tiny little legs. And when they want to move really fast, often they'll tuck their legs against their bodies and like swim through whatever substrate they're on, which is kind of interesting to see, you know, someone without legs. And I think most humans sort of think about not having arms and legs as being, you know, a hardship. But so to see an animal that actually has legs choose to not use them, which means that there must be some benefit to them doing that, especially since we usually see it with alligator lizards when they're trying to get away from us. So they really want to move as fast and efficiently as possible. They stop using their legs and just kind of slither like snakes, which is pretty interesting.
Well, there's that. Thank you for that, because that helps me understand something. I live in the redwood rainforest of Northern California on the coast, and a lot of the salamanders here, not Pacific giant salamanders, but a lot of the salamanders like Del Norte salamanders or other slender salamanders, will have these long bodies with just these stumpy, almost useless legs. And mm-hmm. I always wondered why, but what you said about the forest floor makes perfect sense. That so these salamanders, probably when they really need to move, they probably swim then, like you were saying.
Yeah, I haven't lived other than I grew up in Kentucky, so there were a lot of salamanders there, but I didn't. That was kind of before I spent a lot of time out in the wild looking for reptiles and amphibians like salamanders. But most of the salamanders I've seen in the wild have been, you know, hiding under something. So I haven't seen them move that much. But I do like newts when they swim. And so they have different life stages. They are totally aquatic, but even like the newts that you see walking around on land that are pretty common in Northern California, certain times of the year, if they get in water, I have seen them also do that where they tuck their legs in and kind of, and, you know, and swim in that same sort of snake shape. So I assume they would do that on land if they were trying to get around, even though I haven't seen it. And you have northern alligator lizards there too, which probably also do that land swimming thing. It's kind of interesting. Like, I think that would be really cool to be able to have both options available, have those little stubby legs, which are probably helpful for climbing, maybe easier to climb than snakes, although most snakes are excellent climbers. But then to be able to just sort of like tuck them in and then not really get in the way and mess with your aerodynamics when you're trying to slither or swim through different substrates.
That's great. Keep going, please.
Yeah. So let's see. What else about snakes that makes them snakes? So one big difference between snakes and lizards that is an always difference is that snakes do not have external ear openings. Some lizards also don't, but no snakes have ear openings. So if you see something that looks like an ear, I mean, they don't look like human ears, but they're like little holes that lizards have. So that means it's a lizard. And they also have more prominent jaws than snakes. And another big one, eyelids. So we think of snakes as being without eyelids. And so it's like they can never shut their eyes. But what's actually going on is that their eyelids are clear scales. So their eyes are always closed, but they can also see through them, which I don't understand how you get rest without being able to visually shut out the world, but somehow they manage to do that. And lizards have movable eyelids. So what we normally think of as eyelids, like mammals and birds, and I think pretty much everyone else, oh, not fish. But yeah, so what most animals have, movable eyelids that can blink. So snakes can't blink. They've got these eyes that are always shut, but to us, it just looks like their eyes are always open because their eyelids are clear. And that actually sort of leads to, I think, one of the inherent kind of biases that many people have against snakes that's totally not their own fault and doesn't mean what it thinks we mean. And that's that if you're looking a snake in the face, they're not blinking because they can't. So it just looks like they're staring at you. They're staring at you right in the eyes. And to humans and many other mammals, that seems as very threatening behavior, like some sort of dominance thing. And snakes don't mean anything like that. They just have no choice. If they're looking your way, then they're staring at you, which is kind of interesting and something that didn't really occur to me until the last couple of years that people talk about snakes looking mean, or they were like staring right at me, and you know, they don't have a choice. But to us, like, you know, if I met somebody on the street and from a block away they're just gazing into my eyes and not blinking, like that is pretty terrifying. And you just don't you know, think about that. I never thought about that being a thing with snakes, but that's because, you know, I know why they're doing that, and most people think that, you know, they're just being aggressive with their non-blinking.
So let's talk about what roles, and I'm always uncomfortable talking about what roles beings play in natural communities because that's so utilitarian. You know, mm-hmm. the salmon exist for their own sake, but at the same time, they end up providing just literally tons of food for the forest. And bears exist for their own sake. And at the same time, one of the things they do is they carry the salmon nutrients around and poop them out around the forest. They distribute them. So what are some of the ecological roles that snakes might play in different natural communities?
Yeah, so I think a lot of times people focus on keystone predators or animals that are at the top of the food chain. And we think about those animals as being, if not the only important ones for an ecosystem to function, but like the most important ones, because they're at the top, I don't know. That's a very like human like hierarchy thing with, we think, you know, whoever's in power, like, or, you know, whoever's in charge, they must be like the most powerful and the most important. But I think we know that's not really how it works in human societies either. That's another discussion.
The king of the jungle.
Right. Like a king of the jungle type thing. And I think more and more we're finding out ecologically that is absolutely not the case. And so to a tiny little tangent away from snakes, there's been a lot of information coming out recently that, you know, we're losing a lot of insect diversity. Most of it we don't even know about because they're so, we know so little about them compared to a lot of other groups of animals. And they are so important. They're so important. You know, and even like lower than insects, thinking about soil microorganisms, you know, and there are these tiny things that are, you know, definitely way down low on the food chain, except that they also, a lot of them, you know, eat dead big animals. So also kind of back at the top of the food chain. But they're hugely important. So snakes are in the middle, usually. There's, you know, a couple ecosystems where they are going to be the top predator, but for the most part, they are an important predator, but also an important source of food for other animals. And I think that makes them very special because that means that they're important to everyone else. And, you know, actually, if we start to tease apart animals' roles, I think you could pull out any plant, any animal has that where they are important for everyone else because we're just, it's a whole system. And, you know, when I'm talking to people about why they can't just take all the rattlesnakes out of the forest by their house or, you know, take snakes out altogether, it just, it's one system and we're all dependent upon each other. So snakes, and there's some information specifically about vipers, which include rattlesnakes, copperheads, and cottonmouths that we have in the US, as well as there's a lot of other vipers throughout the world. Because of their slow metabolism and their ability to fast for long periods of time without, sometimes without losing any body mass at all, and that they're fairly tolerant of others of their own species and other snake species, that they have a greater impact on prey than like a mammal predator or a bird predator that are eating the same thing. You know, so even though on a 10-acre forest, you know, a red-tailed hawk is going to eat a lot more rodents in number, but because you're going to have fewer of them because they're territorial, same with a bobcat, you know, you might have, you'll have a lot more rattlesnakes in that same area. So even though each individual is eating less because there's more of them because of that tolerant, they overall make a greater impact. And if the prey population crashes due to drought or some other environmental fluctuation, snakes can just wait that out. And so then when the prey bounces back, you know, they're there. Whereas those mammals and birds probably didn't make it. You know, there's that classical lesson from ecology about crashes and lemmings and then how that affects the, I think it's like a lynx or something is the
predator. Oh, that's snowshoe hare and bobcat. Or that's what it is. I'm sorry, lynx and snowshoe hare.
Yeah, that's what it is.
So can you give a 10-second version of that for people who don't know what it is?
Yeah, so the idea is that you have, it's been a great year for the flowers, for example, that snowshoe hares eat. So there's a ton of them. So then the lynx respond by there's an abundance of snowshoe hares. So they're just gobbling them up like crazy. And then the next year, those flowers aren't doing so well. So the snowshoe hare population crashes. But now you have all of these lynx because they had such a great year last year eating all those snowshoe hares. But now that there's a lot more lynx and there's not enough hares for them. So now their population is going to crash. And then that enables the flowers to then come back because there's not hares to eat them. And so then the hares can come back and there aren't lynx to eat them. And then eventually the lynx hopefully come back depending on how long it goes. But with snakes, they can just sort of, when they're in the lynx position, They just sort of wait and they're like, well, you know, I don't need to eat this year and I'm not going to have babies this year. I'll just wait until all that stuff comes back. And they can do that for a lot longer than, mammals can't go without food for more than a couple weeks, most of us, and some smaller mammals even less time. But snakes can go for months, and some of the bigger snakes can go for years without food.
So before we go on, I want to tell you something that makes me mad, which is nature programs on TV, because anytime you see any alligator or a snake or anything on a nature program, they're eating. And I think it makes us it gives us a distorted view of how alligators or snakes spend most of their time. Spiders too, frankly.
Yeah. I mean, anytime it's a predator, you know, I mean, how often do we get to, I mean, they show it on nature shows, but not as much. Like, you don't see deer browsing for vegetation. But yeah, if it's a show about predators, they almost always show them killing things. And yeah, most predators just, they don't eat that often. Mammals and birds, like, because of needing to have those high metabolisms to keep their bodies warm, they have to eat more often than snakes, but it's still not, you know, that's not how they spend most of their time. And yeah, with snakes, you know, on most nature shows, and honestly, in most, things you read about snakes, and when you hear somebody giving a talk about snakes, you know, they want to talk about who's the biggest, who's the most dangerous to human, who's the most venomous. And then there will be a video of, snakes eating stuff, snakes killing this, snakes killing that. Or if it's a fictional movie, you know, snakes getting ready to attack, usually some cowboy. But yeah, they do so many other things. And when I used to do radio telemetry with rattlesnakes, and so, you know, we have the opportunity to come upon them at any time of day, follow them around. I think I've seen snakes eat in the wild, and I've probably seen them eat more than most people, you know, I don't know, a half dozen times. So maybe six times, something less than 10 out of thousands of encounters with snakes. They just don't eat that much. They spend very little of their time biting and eating anything, but that is not at all the message you get from TV. And it is really cool to see predators do their thing. It's interesting, but it is definitely shortchanging animals to just paint a picture of them as predators. So to move away from that a little bit, talking about like what snakes do and what good they are in the ecosystem, rattlesnakes, there was a study came out, it's been the last few years, I don't remember which year, that shows that they're important for dispersing seeds. And it's partially related to their diet, because sometimes the rodents they eat have, you know, those little like cheek pockets, like full of seeds. And so then the snakes eats them, and then they crawl somewhere else. And then he, leaves a trail of seeds behind in their feces. But also they can get stuff stuck to them as they're just crawling around through vegetation, which a lot of animals do that. You know, we think of pollinators as, you know, insects and birds that are like specifically visiting different plants and moving stuff around. But anyone who's walked around in the in the woods and gotten stuff stuck on their socks and their pants, when that you leave that somewhere else, like, we all do a little bit of pollinating too when we're out there, and snakes do that. And I think the study shows that this isn't just a neat kind of thing. It's actually an important part, or an important way for those seeds to disperse. And that is just not a way that we have ever thought about snakes as being important feed dispersers.
That's really interesting. So do you have more to say about ecological, or should we move on?
I think those are the big ones. So we can move on.
So, okay. One question, you mentioned range, and I remember reading that in this area, in this particular heavily forested area, garter snakes will have, like, I don't know, a square mile range. And that seems like a lot of territory. It seems like a lot of ground to cover for such a little being. Do snakes, I recognize it's an entire huge group of animals, but do they generally have pretty large areas or small areas, or how does that work out? And I know you said they share, but how far might a snake go in a day?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I think what is confusing, so it's a yes, but depends kind of answer, like pretty much everything when we're talking about the natural world. I think because the diversity of snakes is great, you know, a lot of people seem to think about them as being, you know, very similar. They're just like these tubes, but those tubes come in a lot of different sizes and they live in a lot of different places. I mean, anything that's not like into the Arctic Circle or Antarctica has snakes, even the ocean. And some of these snakes are tinier than pencils. Actually, some of them are much tinier than pencils, even as adults. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have green anacondas that can weigh over 300 pounds and reticulated pythons that can be almost 30 feet long. So those large snakes are in general going to have a much greater range than a tiny snake. There's a species of blind snake that is now distributed pretty much throughout the world because they can live their entire life like inside of a flower pot. And that's one of their common names is flower pot snake. And because of that, just as we've like moved plants around for decoration, like now these snakes just kind of, they live in towns all over the place. And they're not really, I don't like the word invasive, but that is not one that's used with this species because they basically just stay in those flower pots. So they have a very tiny home range. And even within the same species. And
what do they eat?
Insects. Right, okay. Vertebrates. Yeah. So they live underground. The native blind snakes, and there's probably somewhere you are too, but in the southwestern US, we have a few species of native blind snakes and a lot of them eat termite larvae. And I imagine also probably don't travel very far, but because they're so small, you can't do radio telemetry with them. You know, like for those who don't know what radio telemetry is, I should have explained this before. It's like when people talk about putting collars on wolves and other mammals. Obviously, you can't put a collar on a snake because they would just crawl right out of it. So they have to be surgically implanted, which means that you have to have a pretty large animal to do that in safely. And with something as tiny as these little pencil-sized blind snakes, they're not even big enough for traditional ways of marking individuals. So we really know very little about them. But they do eat termite larvae and other like tiny, tiny little invertebrates. So I think in general, a mile does sound like a lot of area for a garter snake to cover because they're, you know, somewhere in the middle. They're a pretty small snake, not tiny. And I think a lot of times when biologists talk about the home range of an animal, so they're including everything within a big circle of where the snake spends their time during the active season when they're hunting and they're looking for mates. But also the place they have to go over the winter to keep themselves from freezing. A lot of times these overwintering spots also have a role to play in the social behavior of those snakes. And the further you move from the equator, the more likely those snakes are going to have to travel longer distances to find an appropriate place to spend the winter. So Western prairie rattlesnakes in New Mexico probably have a pretty small home range because they don't really, in southern New Mexico, like they don't have to worry about freezing much over the winter. I mean, it gets cold, but not like it does in Idaho, where they also live. So in New Mexico, it's probably no more than a quarter or a half mile in between their den and where they spend the summer. It may even be the same place. It may totally overlap, but in the northern part of the range in the northern U.S. and into southern Canada, those snakes may travel several miles between where they spent the winter and where they're going to feed. Now, they're not covering that distance every day, and it's actually more like a migration. They, you know, come out in the spring and they make one long linear movement to their summer area. And then in the fall, they reverse that. So although their home range is giant, I mean, miles, where they're actually moving on a day-to-day basis is pretty small. And it's more accurately represented by, you know, thinking of like there's this dot over here where they spend the winter, and then all these other places over here that are going to be much closer together where they're spending the summer. And so even within the same species, how variable their habitat is where they live and how abundant the things are that they need in that habitat. So if there's a lot of things to eat, a lot of places to hide, lots of options to spend the winter, they're not going to have to move very much. If it's a little sparser, so even not a cold place, but like a really harsh desert that, you know, is very hot, vegetation's kind of limiting, then they might have to move around more there to find the things that they need as well.
So it's kind of like a human who might spend their summers in, you mentioned Idaho, in Coeur d'Alene, and then their winters in Tucson. So, but when they're in Coeur d'Alene, they only go, you know, 10 miles from home. And when they're in Tucson, they only go 10 miles from home.
Exactly. And you would not consider any of the states in between those places part of your home, even though you have homes on either side of it. Exactly. Same thing.
So how do they navigate? And also, do these territories, are they generational? Do they go back to the same summer home every year? And then do their children go there? And how do they find their way? Like, I know dung beetles use the stars to navigate.
That is a very good question. So on a small scale, snakes use smell to find places they're familiar with. Like that's how they like, oh, they can pick up the a good scent trail, and they know that that's a good place to hunt because it smells like there's a lot of mammals there, lizards or whatever they're eating. They will also track females that way, both, you know, that one's in this area, and then also the specific path a female is taking when they're getting like close enough to go after her. That is how baby rattlesnakes find their mother's den, is by tracking her smell. So they're not following her like in a little line, although that would be adorable as far as I know, it doesn't happen, but they will follow her scent trail back to the den. And we think that's probably how, if you stick a snake in a strange place where they don't like snakes that have been translocated, that they may also try to use that to find an overwintering site as well. And the how they find their way back to the summer, I guess, is more from memory. The overwintering site is one of the most important, especially in colder places, because that's, you know, if you don't have a good site, like you're gonna freeze to death. and the rest of it, you've got, because of their ability to go without food, you've got a little more play and, you know, in finding a good spot. So it seems like with the overwintering sites, the dens, that those are, they're used by multi-generations. Like I said, we've seen at sites that we've studied, and I've seen this published on other species of rattlesnakes, where they have seen that the babies track the female scent to get back to the den. And if you look within a den or an overwintering spot, at least with some rattlesnakes, that those animals are more closely related than from other dens. And, you know, even with some of the dens that we've studied that are pretty close together, and close together, so not in that sort of, well, they're within a mile, so they could go, but I mean, like within the range that a snake would travel on a day to day, like 300 yards in between them, 400 yards, but you do not see any mixing. You don't see babies that were born to mother from Den A showing up in Den B. If they show up again, they're in Den A. They're not in Den B. And we're guessing that that's probably how those dens form and are maintained, by babies coming back and using their mother's den. So kind of a matrilineal society going on there. But there's not a, I mean, it's, we know a little bit about those dynamics in timber rattlesnakes. And then we've started to see that in our studies of Arizona black rattlesnakes, but it's difficult to do long-term studies on snakes. I mean, doing long-term studies on any animals are hard because grants and things, like, they want answers to questions like right now. And that is, you know, our world is capitalist and everybody needs money to do stuff. And so that is often how science is determined too, on what you can get money and opportunity to do. And it's really hard to travel them or to track those sorts of things in a particular population through years and years and years. There aren't that many examples of places that or people that have done that, unfortunately.
Okay, so before we move on to human snake relations, I have another question. I'm sorry that this is such an ignorant question. So snakes, I'm asking this because when I said how far they travel, and then you talked about the tremendous diversity of snakes, what would be the equivalent category of snake within mammals? Is it like, is it the equivalent of primates, or is it the equivalent of something broader? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, that is a good question. I think, man, you know, I think it would be primates, but although I'm wondering if it's, you know, there's the constant change with how we decide what's what, because I'm wondering if lizards are more akin, or the group lizards is more akin to primates than snakes would be. And then, like, maybe snakes would be like the great apes or something within primates, but I'm not sure, because how and who decides what is a class and then like a subclass. It's something like that. Or, you know, snakes are like waterfowl.
Right.
It includes a lot of species. I think the count is somewhere around 3,000 snake species. There are a ton of them, and it's so easy because, you know, in general, they look so different from us. It's so easy to want to collapse them all and talk about snakes in general. And I spend a lot of time talking about snakes in general too, even though there's so much diversity. I mean, even within rattlesnakes, which are, you know, a group within a group within a group of snakes.
Well, one reason I asked that is because a couple of years ago, I was reading about predator mites, M-I-T-E-S. Predator mites eat herbivorous mites. And I was reading an account by an entomologist who talked about them being cannibalistic. And the nerd in me and the anal retentive person in me went crazy. So I had to look this up, and mites is basically as broad a category almost as like mammals or four-legged mammals or something. So the point is that them calling the predatory mites cannibalistic is as silly as calling wolf cannibalistic because it eats deer. The point I'm trying to get at is that, well, a mite's a mite, but no, actually there's like 5,000 species of mites, and they're as different from each other as we are from, I don't know, lemurs.
I totally get that, because it drives me crazy too, because often you'll be like, king snakes are the good snakes because they're cannibalistic. They eat other snakes. That does not make them cannibals, because other snakes are different species. And although in captivity, king snakes will eat other king snakes, like of their own species, animals in captivity do a lot of things that aren't natural. I don't think they're like seeking out other king snakes to eat. And I have seen videos and pictures of king snakes, you know, even fighting with other king snakes in the wild, and that does not end in eating. It's, you know, they're different species. And I think I made the comparison that that would be like calling humans cannibalistic for eating cows, just because they're also mammals.
Right, right. So we have like 15 minutes left, and I'm just loving what you're saying so far. And I have two stories I want to tell very quick about human-snake relations. And one of them is that, you know, I've seen not as many snakes as you, but I've seen quite a few snakes in my life. And I only had one scary experience. And of course, it's a scary experience that I'm going to mention, which, and I've always wondered what the snake was thinking. And then my second story, well, I'll tell the second story first, which is I interviewed someone from India about king cobras and how king cobras kill, I don't know, it's like 40,000 people a year. It's a lot. And he does a lot of work on educating people about it. And one of his big things is just getting people to wear Wellingtons or getting to wear rubber boots when they go out in the field. And I said, is there a hatred of snakes in India, kind of like there is a hatred of wolves in the Western United States? He's like, no. I don't have a problem with, I have no difficulty telling people not to hate snakes. They don't hate them here. It's purely technical. You know, that everybody understands a snake's not trying to hurt you. They understand, they have great respect for and affection for the snakes. So that's kind of a yay snakes, even though they are kind of scary in that circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other story is just, you know, we have this so often. A lot of us find, a lot of people in general find snakes really creepy and scary. So now my particular story, I was at some little state or national park in Mississippi one time and rented a canoe, and I'm paddling around the lake, and all of a sudden, I guess a water moccasin came up out of the blue and struck at the paddle. Didn't do anything to me. But I was thinking, man, if I would have been dangling my leg over, it was like completely unprovoked. And so there's my scary snake story. And I don't understand what the snake was thinking.
I don't want to pretend to speak on behalf of all snakes. but, you know, I assume in cases like that, and, you know, and this would be the same thing for the very rare, but it does happen when somebody, you know, steps like over a log or next to a rock shelter or something, a bush where a snake is hunting. There's something about that movement that seems prey-like to them. And I assume that's what is happening with the paddle. You know, and it's like, yes, at, you know, at some level, especially an older, more experienced snake, you know, They're using all their senses, viper or pit vipers, which water moccasins or cottonmouths, same thing. They're in that group. So, you know, they have the ability to tell if something is warmer or not. And so oftentimes they are less likely to bite things that aren't warm or aren't alive, but not always. I mean, they bite things that scientists use to pick them up occasionally. But they have a very little time to make that decision. And they, you know, again, talking about this idea about predators not eating very often. And a lot of the reason for that isn't because they don't want to, it's just because the opportunities to kill and eat something, it's not like just walking into the grocery store. It's hard work to make that happen. And so, you know, they often err on the side of like, I'm just going to go ahead and go after it, especially when it doesn't seem like something that's dangerous, which a paddle probably wouldn't. And same thing with like the heel of somebody's shoe or a toe getting too close to a place where a snake is hunting. So it can happen. Because otherwise they just have no reason to bite anyone. It's good defense. Why would you want to put your face into contact with something scary? It's usually a last resort when they're picked up or somebody's trying to kill them, or if they think it's food.
Well, I wanted to tell one more story I just remembered. Which goes the other direction, sort of erase the water moccasin story. That I was I was like 8 or 9 or something, and this is in Colorado, and I was scrambling through a bush, like following a lizard, and I hear this bee buzzing by my ear, and I wave it away, and then it doesn't wave away. So I do it again, and it still doesn't go away. So I look over, and there's a rattlesnake, maybe, oh, I don't know, probably 4 inches from my face. And it didn't do anything, and I didn't do anything. And I of course, retreated. But it was very, I mean, if there was some giant alien being that is, you know, 400 times my weight, you know, I would certainly do some sort of threat display to try to get it away.
Yeah, totally. I mean, we're scary. I think that because we're scared of them, that a lot of times it's really hard for us to consider that, you know, to them, we look like a T-Rex. You know, I used to say it's like a giant tree that could come at you. So in other words, it's like if you saw a Tyrannosaurus Rex, like in real life, like that's the size difference. You know, they recognize that we're predators because we have forward facing eyes, and we're just big and scary, even if they're just worried about getting stepped on. And they obviously have much more to worry about us that, you know, than just getting stepped on. And, you know, so they're going to try to do stay still so they won't be seen, rattle if they're a rattlesnake, put on some other bluff display. So like cottonmouths and water moccasins are famous for gaping and showing this bright white mouth, which is startling when you see it, you know, doing anything they can. And the last resort they have is biting. You know, they can't reach out and scratch you like a cat. They don't have talons, you know, all they have is their mouth if all those other things don't work. But, you know, I liken it to it really is a last resort, because if you're scared enough to even be considering these things, why in the world would you want to put your face like closer to the threat? I mean, it's a last resort. And that's why you hear at least as many stories like you described of, you know, the rattlesnake sort of rattling or even doing nothing but being very close to you. I mean, I've stepped right over large rattlesnakes. I don't know how I didn't see them. It doesn't speak to my, you know, skills as a snake biologist, I guess, but, and just had him do nothing, just sit absolutely still, because they just don't want to be seen.
So now let's go to what is your perspective on the attitude? What is your experience of the attitude of a lot of, not people like you who are explicit snake lovers, but what is your perception of people's attitude towards snakes? Do you think that most people don't like snakes? Do you think most people don't think about them? Do you think most people see them and go, oh, that's kind of nice? That's like, there's three garter snakes who live right outside my door, and I love seeing them. You know, it makes my day. I see them every day in the summer because they're always sunning at one specific place, and I love seeing them.
Well, I love to hear that. And I also think that that probably makes you a little weird, not as weird as me, but a little weird. Because even though garter snakes are completely harmless and these wonderful little garden helpers that provide free pest control, and again, like totally harmless, that people still view them with fear or hate for the most part. And you know, and people will tell me that have a genuine fear or just don't like them. You know, they tell me and then immediately they apologize. Well, some of them apologize for feeling that way. And it's like, you know, you shouldn't apologize like this. This isn't on you personally. And I'm just going to speak about Americans for the moment, because that's where I'm from. And so that's what I know best. But this is what we grew up with. Everything in our culture teaches us that snakes are evil and out to get us, whether it's if you grew up in a Christian household, you know, that's the chapter one of the Bible, as a snake ruined it all. It's popular movies like the Harry Potter series, where snakes were aligned with evil wizards. Even Indiana Jones, tough guy, recognizes that snakes are too scary for him. And even in nature documentaries, like we already talked about, they're portrayed as, you know, killing, cold-blooded killing machines, you know, and then every Western movie and TV show ever always has that scene of a rattlesnake, like waiting to attack someone. And what you don't get to see are that those same snakes, so like rattlesnakes, for instance, are caring mothers that care for their kids the first couple weeks of their lives. also will babysit other rattlesnakes. Rattlesnakes often share nest sites, and especially the younger mothers will care for other babies before their own are born. Sometimes males and juvenile snakes will show up at these nest sites and help care for babies too. There's some evidence that family members retain some of these bonds later in life, like tend to hang out closer to each other at these communal overwintering den sites than the non-relatives do, especially the females. And, you know, just all these cool things, like they're social. Rattle or garter snakes prefer to be in groups than by themselves. Rattlesnakes have preferences for who they want to hang out with and who they don't, even within the den they share. It's not a homogenous group. You have little like cliques and stuff. So there's all these other fascinating things, but that's not what we hear. And so most people, especially in this country, have this great fear of snakes, which is sometimes molds into hatred. And it's interesting, your story about India, because this is a place where you have snakes that are much more deadly to human, much more toxic venom, and medical care for snake bites is not it's just not readily available in most places. You have tens of thousands of people that die from venomous snake bites there. Like it's a legit health hazard. Whereas in the US, it's less than 5 people that die from snake bites. And that includes people who think it's fun to like have a pet cobra, you know, as well as legitimate bites from people stepping too close to a snake, like we discussed before. But in India, and it, you know, of course there are exceptions to this. They're not a homogenous group of people either, but like you said, I think that attitude of they're just part of our lives here seems to be more typical than it is in the US, where we just still have this manifest destiny, like conquer and annihilate anything that we feel is threatening or competing with us, even though there's such a minor threat that's pretty easy to live with. And when our organization first started talking to people about how we can live with snakes in a way that takes these conflict situations that sometimes, although pretty rarely, end badly for people, but are often lethal for snakes, and turn it into something, you know, like you with your garter snakes, it's just like, it's a joy to see them. They're so cool. You can see them do interesting things. You can treat it like bird watching. You know, we used to say that like our tips for living with snakes, you know, we're just talking about the US. Like, we don't want to say that this works in places that have truly deadly snakes. But, and I don't know if it was the same group that you spoke to from India, but watching some videos from, it's a crocodile organization, but they do a lot of work with king cobras too in India. They have a series of videos that talks about how to live safely around king cobras and all the other cobras and vipers. And it is the same things that we talk about. Use a flashlight or a torch at night. Wear shoes. Don't sleep on the ground outside. That's more of an issue there than here, just because there are more snakes. You know, don't keep piles of trash around your house, or be very careful when you're moving the trash or just moving around it, because those are places that attract snake food, and so they attract snakes. You know, be careful if you feed and water birds. You have to take care and be intentional with how you do that, and recognize that you are pulling in all their, you're attracting all their other predators too. And that's actually what they've found there to be most effective in preventing snake bites. It's not about killing or moving every snake that shows up. Although, yeah, if there's a cobra in your bedroom or a rattlesnake, it's a good idea to have someone who knows how to handle them safely get them out of the house. But that doesn't mean they need to be driven 10 miles away and dumped in a wash somewhere. That's not helping anybody.
Well, that's all really great stuff. We have like 2 minutes left. So one is, I want to ask you how it was that you so much fell in love with snakes. And if we can somehow use that as a lesson for other people to help them fall in love with snakes? And then also, can you talk about your organization just a little bit and how people can learn more about you?
Sure. So I fell in love with snakes. It sort of like carried over from a childhood fascination with dinosaurs and snakes through crocodiles, and then snakes being one that were in my backyard. I grew up in Kentucky. There were garter snakes in my backyard. And, you know, I thought they were really interesting. I appreciated that they were different. I think that, and that's still the case, like as a scientist, I just think that makes them more interesting to figure out. It's just more of a challenge than a mammal, which shares so many similarities with people. And, you know, like I said, snakes have, we have some shared traits as well, but their difference makes them interesting to me. But I think what really kept me going and kept my interest in snakes and definitely played a huge role in how we moved from studying them to having this organization and advocating for them is I noticed early on as a kid with my very first pet snake when I was like 7 or 8 years old, that most people don't feel the way that I do about snakes and that you do about snakes, that they're scared of her. They're scared of them. And, you know, that means that they don't get as much attention in research. That also means that it's very hard to conserve them, to put in measures that would either benefit them or to stop things from being done that are harming snakes. I mean, we've had lots of people when we worked doing more sort of typical applied conservation biology that would just look at us and say, but isn't it a good thing if the fire kills all the rattlesnakes here? Why would we want those?
And really? Conservation biologists say that?
No, not conservation biologists, people who, okay, who I would run into.
Okay.
I'm sure there are a few that have said things like that. It's kind of amazing. Or say things like, you know, well, couldn't we just have a non-rattlesnake that eats the same things? And, you know, and then that gets back into services and balancing that versus like, this is their home too, and their home first. But no, it was more everyday people asking us. And so that was the real trigger with moving from studying snakes, because all the data in the world on what is helpful for snakes or what is harmful for snakes is absolutely useless if people don't care. Because when people don't care, the management agencies in charge have less power to do anything about it. And so we formed Advocates for Snake Preservation to bridge that gap, to help people care about snakes so that that information about how we can help the ones that need to be helped and how we can stop harm from coming to them in general, that can be put into effect. And so that's why we tend to focus on behaviors of snakes that people like, and are also just stuff that haven't gotten a lot of attention, like parental care and sociality, and often sometimes just showing them doing anything but being a predator, just because it's different. Like, we just posted a video on YouTube recently that just showed a couple of snakes trying to fit inside the small opening to this den site that's in an old house. And that's it. They were just trying to fit into this spot. But that really got a lot of people's attention, because that's just not something you get to see. It's just different. And it makes you think of all these questions like, oh, the snake that was too big to fit in there, you know, has he been using this his whole life? And now is he going to have to find, you know, and just all, you know, all these questions that people pose that really makes us think about them as individuals with their own stories and histories. And I think thinking about animals, including other people that way, really helps us care about them, because that makes them seem more real instead of just a threat, something scary, et cetera, et cetera.
So one last thing, how will people, do you have a website? How will people find out more about Advocates for Snake Preservation?
Yeah, so the easiest way to find out more about us, especially on the topic of coexisting with snakes, is to go to livingwithsnakes.org.
Okay, great. Is there any last thing you want to say, or are you good?
I think we're good. Be kind to snakes.
And also, I just want to do one callback, and then we'll be done. The reason I didn't ask you more about the snake socializing is that we talked about that pretty extensively in our previous interview. So if people want to hear more about the snake socializing from you, having to do with me, they can look through the archives to find a previous interview where you talked about that pretty extensively. And I got to admit, you totally blew my mind with that.
It's pretty cool.
Anyway, I would like to thank you for all your great work in the world, and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Melissa Amarello. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.